This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
Hi, I'm Monuente Reme. I played Icheb on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Metatrex on Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Welcome to episode 21 of Metatrex, Trek FM's show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Mike Morrison, and with me is Zachary Frueling. In this episode, we'll be joined by Manu Intireme, also known as Icheb on Star Trek Voyager. Well, Zachary, I am really stoked about this conversation.
I couldn't be more excited, Mike. I've been looking forward to this all week. Anyone who knows me knows that Voyager is my favorite Star Trek show. I love the family that we see on Voyager, the way it's portrayed. They're my favorite Star Trek characters by far, and Icheb is part of the family, so I am really looking forward to a fascinating discussion with Manu tonight.
Yeah, I was really excited because I was promoting Metatrex and interacting on one of the many Facebook groups that I'm a part of, and he actually pinged me and asked if he could have an opportunity to come on. And he's been very, very busy working on his latest project, which we'll talk about when we discuss his current projects with him. But, you know, traveling to Spain and all points around the world, getting this thing going, and for him to be willing to take the time out to come on and talk to us about his time playing Icheb on Voyager and other projects he's done, things he's currently working on. It's very exciting.
Yeah, there are those of us that are fans that we watch Star Trek. We tend to be passive observers, even though we're making a podcast here on Star Trek. And there are people who've lived the experience of being in Star Trek. And Manu, of course, has that experience. And Manu, it's clear from following him on Facebook and following him on this project he's working on, The Circuit, that we'll talk about later. It's clear that he's a thinking actor. You know, he has plenty of ideas and directions he wants to see entertainment go, talents that he brings to the table. And I'm just looking forward to picking his brain about all things entertainment and Star Trek and a little bit of philosophy. And I want to see what we can learn from him, given his experience that you and I don't have.
Yeah, for our listeners, I think this will be, to some degree, a little outside the box, but I don't think those listeners who really enjoy the philosophical discussions, I don't think they'll be disappointed at all.
Well, it's funny you say that, Mike, because, you know, on the one hand, here on Metatrex, we tend to dive into very heavy philosophical episodes, you know, free will, philosophical topics, free will and determinism, ethics and whatnot. And then there are sort of the lighter-hearted philosophical topics, you know, the kinds of things that you can learn in listening to other people talk about their own experiences. You know, you've got your experiences, I've got mine, Manu's got his, and in listening to all of us talk about our experiences, we hope that listeners out there learn something true about the human experience based on different people's experiences. So that's what I hope we bring to the table. It's kind of a phenomenology of acting in Star Trek.
Well, what do you say we don't keep our listeners waiting any longer?
Without further suspense, let's bring Manu into the room.
Well, Zachary, this is going to be a very exciting podcast, something a little out of the box for us here on Metatrex. We have a very special guest with us today here on the Starship Theseus, none other than Manu Intireme, who really needs no introduction among the Star Trek fans. As all of our listeners are probably aware, Manu portrayed Icheb in Star Trek Voyager throughout the last half of Season 6 and all of Season 7, and joins us here today. Manu, welcome.
Hi, guys. I really do need no introduction with that last name. It gets butchered on every talk show that I do.
Did I do okay?
You did okay. You, I, it's C minus. The story that I tell that always makes me feel better about it was I got the part to play Alvin Karpis across from Leo DiCaprio in the movie J. Edgar. And I got to work on it for 2 days, and a lot of my scenes, actually almost 98% of what I shot, got cut. But I'm still in the film, and DiCaprio still busts me. But what was neat was that Clint Eastwood directed the film. And so I got to get directed by Eastwood. And the first day I was nervous. Do I call him Mr. Eastwood? Do I call him Clint? Do I call him Sir? Do I call et cetera? Same with DiCaprio. And when I walked on set, I had my 1940s outfit on. Alvin Karpis was a famous bank robber, and my glasses and these spectacle glasses and this, I forget the name of the hat, like a boater hat. And Eastwood is across the way at the studio, and he pegs me with those eyes, and he slowly sets down his screener. He's got this screen that he watches the takes on. And he slowly starts sauntering over towards me. And I'm kind of, you know, looking behind me like, is he looking at me? What's going on? And he slowly struts over, and it's him. It's the man, you know, he's the man. He gets all the way over to me and he goes, well, if it isn't Manu, blah, blah, blah. And then he elbows me and he winked. And I immediately felt like I was a part of the team, and it was Uncle Eastwood. And, you know, it was a great way for him to just welcome me to the set, you know. Didn't even try it. Just, hey, it's Manu, whatever.
So are you giving us permission to call you Uncle Manu?
You can, yeah, Uncle Manu or
Uncle Manu. Blah, blah, blah.
But it's Ente Reme.
Ente Reme.
Yeah.
Got it. All right, well, C minus. I'll take it.
You said interiami, which is what most.
Did I say interiami?
Something close to that, which is, you know, most people go get that extra little vowel sound and syllable in there. Interiami, may.
I saw you had it written phonetically on your Facebook page. Interiami. How do they do?
Uh huh. That's it.
All right, interiami.
Yeah,
but faster than that probably.
Yeah, it's interiami.
So, Manu, we want to start out, talk a little bit about your work on Voyager. You came into Star Trek Voyager during the middle of season 6 for the episode Collective, and you became a recurring character through the end of the series run. What was your experience as an actor coming into the show and into such a storied franchise like Star Trek?
I've answered this question so many times that I don't know whether it's true or not anymore. and the answer to the question. And it's also been so long. It's been 20 years, which is crazy. Has it been 20 years? No, it's been more like 15 years for me. When did I come on? 2001, 2000, something like that. So, okay, not 20 years, 15, but still. I was a kid, you know, I was 21 years old when I got that part. So there was a lot of things going on when I got. I was excited to be on the show to begin with. I hadn't watched Next Gen, and I hadn't watched Deep Space. I wasn't a TV show Star Trek fan, but I was a deep fan of the films. I'd seen every Star Trek film. So I knew that I was going, you know, I was going to get beamed up sooner or later, maybe, you know, that was pretty exciting. I was excited to go on. I didn't think I was going to be there for more than an episode either. So it was exciting to play this character that was half human, lost in himself, half robot, half, well, Borg, but half robotic. I thought the episode was well written. I thought the character was well written. I was also angry because I had auditioned for the bad guy that dies in the end, the Borg one, and they had called to say, we don't want to give you that part, but we want to give you the weak one that, you know, saves the day in the end. And he's more, you know, he's a little bit weaker than he's not the villain. Turns out that was a good thing. But there was a lot going on in my head, making that first episode. What I do remember that was different about most shows was that the cast was very welcoming to a new guest star. And usually about 8 out of 10 TV stars. What are we rated on this show? It's Trek FM, so we must be a family thing, PG, right?
Yeah.
Most TV stars are a-holes. About, you can count on it, about 7 out of 10 of them. I don't know why that is. Most, about 9 out of 10 legitimate A-list movie stars are really enlightened, humble, cool people. And TV stars, for some reason, tend to be egomaniacs and self-centered and angry, and I don't know what is going on. But you can 20 years in the business, trust me, you can count on that. Voyager was different. I got there and every cast member, there wasn't any friction. It was very much a welcoming set. I felt like I was part of the family very quick from really the first day of shooting. I'm walking around in all this makeup and pantyhose and Borg gear and outfit, and things are falling off of me. And if you were on a guest star of a show with actors that weren't nice, that could be a really horrible 2-week experience. But I thoroughly enjoyed it. And then, of course, it turned into another, 2 years work and a new character to play. And I don't have many bad memories from working on Voyager. And even those 15 years past, I think back on as good. Mm. I was working on a spaceship, for God's sakes, how could pretend on a gigantic spacecraft, even when you're sick. There was one episode called Q2 where I was running like 103 degree fever for most of the shoot. And if you go back and you watch the episode, you can see how sick I am. I'm about to fall down in every take. But even going back and thinking about that feels fun. It was a great time.
Manu, one of your comments about Voyager being something like a family speaks to me, because for me, Voyager was always one of my favorite Star Trek series. It's a show I go back to. I would even say that it's like my bedtime story at night. I'll put it on before I go to bed, that kind of thing. But I do that because of the family element. It's relaxing. You can see that the characters on the show engage with each other. They feel like a family. They're stuck in the Delta Quadrant. Can you tell me just a little bit about how the character of Ichep was conceived, and what role he was supposed to play in the Voyager family? What role did he serve? Of course, there's the relationship between him and Seven of Nine, as maybe a surrogate parental relationship. But can you just give us a little backstory on how the character was described to you when you came on the show?
They didn't describe anything to me. There wasn't really any direction from the management, from Berman and Braga, all the way down to the directors that directed me. Once you get a part in something, unless you're doing something wrong, nobody tells you any direction. So I think the only direction I ever really remember receiving was in Collective. My character had to talk to the Borg mind, or to his other Borg on the ship. And Robert Beltran went over and he tapped me on the shoulder and he said, "Hey, when the Borg talk to each other, just tilt your head like this and close your eyes, or that's how they do it. So just do that." That's really the only direction that I can remember getting. I think as far as how the character was conceived, to this day, I have no real idea. I asked Brian Fuller at Vegas last year who thought of Ichab, he said Jerry Taylor and Piller were the guys that wrote him, and then Fuller wrote him quite a bit too. But from an acting level, I was on every other episode basically for that last couple of years, and I never knew whether I was going to die. I never knew whether my character was going to come back. And every couple 3 weeks, I would get a phone call saying, "Hey, it's time to do another episode." And I would get the screenplay and I would open it. And almost, I've told this story before, but it's true. And if you go back and you look at the Ichab episodes, in almost every one of the episodes that focuses on him, he almost dies. So from the beginning of the screenplay, they're killing me off. And I'm getting through it. Oh, they're killing me off. This is my last episode. And by the end of it, I would stay alive and I'd do a little, Home Alone thing, and then I'd wait for the next one to come along.
Is there something like an actor's paranoia? You know, every week you show up, you're afraid your character is going to be killed off. You don't know if you're coming back to work next week. It sounds really exhausting in a way.
Absolutely. And then there was this, you know, there was a lot of inner set stress because there was all this, this was the final season as well. So there was all this, things filtered down through from the creatives at the top and the execs and the writers all the way down through the cast and et cetera. And you start hearing rumors, and everybody was telling me that I was going to be offered a contract for the new show, that the new show was going to be called, what's the name of the school?
Academy. Starfleet Academy.
Called Star Trek Academy. So that rumor was very rampant back then. And almost every day I went to work, somebody was telling me or tapping me and saying, hey, the contract's going to be coming pretty soon. You're going to be on the new show. And that never happened. So that was also, like, you know, disappointing. But what was the question? I got sidetracked.
Yeah, I think I was just asking, you know, how was the character of Ichep originally conceived?
Oh, yeah, how was he conceived?
Yeah, I think he played a certain role on the show, right? He was supposed to be someone for Seven of Nine to look after. And so I think, you know, he certainly filled a function on the show.
I know what my answer to the question was. As far as writing goes and as far as character goes, they wrote a great story. And like all great TV shows, especially TV shows that have season after season after season, if they find a great story, they tell it again. And I think the first time was with Data. The second time was Hugh Borg. Here's this kid. He discovers himself. He's finds what it's like to have emotion to get out of his machine. Then it was Seven of Nine, and the captain did it for Seven. And then Seven, of course, needed to... She found her identity, and now she had somebody to, she played the captain's role for her. So they told the story again, basically, and they just used Ichab to tell that great story for the fourth time, in my mind.
It's like every time they tell that story, the previous characters get a promotion. You know, Seven of Nine has to discover her humanity. So then she gets a promotion. Now she gets to look after Ichab, who discovers his humanity, and so on.
Yeah, she gets to see what motherhood's like and what caring's about. And I got to find out what it was like to not only discover myself, but just to discover my manhood at the same time as you're battling your programming. And it's a really beautiful story that I think a lot of movies have taken a look at, you know, when a cyborg becomes human, it's a really interesting thing. A great movie recently, what was that called? It was with the girl robot and the actor from Star Wars.
Is it Ex Machina?
Yeah. Did you see that?
I haven't seen it yet. It's on my list though.
Oof, that's a good one. There's a great, like, what would it be like for AI to function? What would that experience be for it? So that's really besides the motherhood and the cute things about the story was, what's it like for this thing to function?
You know, it's funny you question the what's it like aspect, because, you know, this is a show on Star Trek and philosophy, so we tend to dive into some deep philosophical issues. But this being the 50th anniversary of Star Trek, one issue that keeps coming up again and again for us is the question of meaning. What did Star Trek mean for fans? What does it mean to the actors? And so this is kind of just a question for you. What did being on a show like Star Trek, with its, you know, sort of lofty moral and ethical vision, mean? What did it mean being part of a franchise where it's a given, I think, that your name will be remembered 25 years or 50 years or 75 years from now. You're part of a franchise that has a longevity to it. What is it like to be involved in something like that? You know, that's not something I can relate to just from the standpoint. I think we're, in a way, we're envious. You know, we want to be on that starship.
It's a very hard question to answer, too, to make simple. What's it like to be a part of Star Trek? Can you even define Star Trek, right? I've been a part of Star Trek now, even off the show and onto these Renegades films, 15 something years. What was it like? Phenomenal, period. You know, we can, I could talk about a million things about, at first I was 20 and I was suddenly, I was famous. I was making good money. I was doing, playing this great character. Hollywood was interested in me. I was traveling. I was going to conventions where everybody treated you like a prince. I was young. I was dumb. I didn't rightly, I went on stage and would say stupid things because I didn't really, I was young. So I didn't know that you leave a wake when you become a part of something that big, and everything you say about it and or about yourself and life, you leave a wake behind you, mm-hmm. you know, that you don't see. It's like in theater, you get to see what your performance does to people. And what's kind of neat about Star Trek that I sort of realized as I got older was I got to go to these different cultures and different places around the world and stand on stage in front of thousands and hundreds of people and have a real human connection and an experience with them for an hour. And those questions that people answer, whether it was philosophy or about literature or life or God or meaning, mattered. And when I was younger, I was more about entertaining the audience and making people laugh. And now I'm more about, hey, maybe I have something to say to these people. Maybe there's a reason for, there's a reason for a Q&A, right? People come in not to just find out how long it took to put the makeup on, but to find out about each other. And sometimes those Q&As can be like a religious experience. And not in the effect of like I'm preaching, but in the sense that we're all connected, you know, and in the scientific sense of there's no difference between Mike Morris and Zachary and Monty. We're all human beings and we're all doing our best to figure out what the heck we're doing here.
Yeah.
So, you know, in my older age, it's been a journey, you know, it's been a long, amazing journey that, Well, you're right. I won't ever get away from it. It won't ever not be a part of my life. It's not like someday that's ever going to turn off. So I've hated it at some times, and at other times I've hated myself for hating it. And other times I've been humble and it just so thankful for it. Recently it was, Renegades, I saw a screening of Star Trek Renegades in Las Vegas, and I really enjoyed it, and it was beautiful, and Walter was there, and he was sort of, there was a standing ovation at the end of the show, and it wouldn't be exactly how I would have made the film. I would have made it less campy, but it was still great. It was great in that theater. And I had seen it a few months before. So in that experience in Las Vegas, I saw, you know, Tim Russ and Walter Koenig and all these, Robert Picardo and all these people that have been a part of my life for so long doing this version of Star Trek that wasn't the $1 million version that I'd seen before. And it was the weirdest feeling because I had seen it 4 months ago in Germany, but it wasn't quite ready yet. And so it wasn't very watchable. And I was sitting in Germany and I never felt more humble and thankful to be a part of something so terrifyingly bad because the movie wasn't finished. And so there was this weird feeling of like, wow, I'm so thankful to be a part of this weird thing where everyone has a nose like this and wears a, and then this weird space opera. And at the same time, I was like, it's so embarrassing to be a part of this. And then 4 months later, when the movie was ready, it was just pure humble thankfulness to be a part of that family. So it's kind of like family, right? It's a love-hate relationship. Sometimes you love your brothers and your parents, and sometimes you hate it. You know, I keep an open. You know, a lot of celebrities will just bull crap you, and they'll just say, "Oh, it's wonderful, and everybody was great." And, you know, it's been a yin and a yang for me, you know. I sometimes think, wow, this has been such a blessing for my life. And then at other times I think, wow, this has been such a curse for my life. And, you know, it's up and down and left and right like life is.
You mentioned Renegades. We can go ahead and kind of dive into Renegades a little bit. The thing that I probably find most interesting about Icheb's character is, you know, originally when the character was conceived, he was engineered to some degree by his parents to really be a weapon of mass destruction to use against the Borg. And of course, this being a Star Trek and philosophy podcast, it raises some really interesting philosophical and ethical questions. So when you reprise the role as Icheb in Renegades, Icheb was older, somewhat darker version of the character that we got to know in Voyager. So what was that experience like, and how did that all kind of play into the way you reprised the role and how you played, and what are your thoughts about Icheb's evolution?
There were two things about Renegades, the same thing that I was talking about earlier. You get an attachment to your character and you start to have a relationship with him, and you care very much about what writers do with him. And I was really excited to a lot of things happened in Renegades with me and the producer and the writers. And it was sort of, you know, we got into a few fights. And in the end, I think it came out just fine. And the character of Icheb, it was neat. I would really like in the second episode to get to see a little bit more. I really liked the idea. I really liked that Icheb got back home. He went to Starfleet and he joined what he thought would be a way to help people, and a way to that Section 31 signed him up, telling him you're going to help people that have been assimilated by the Borg, come back to themselves, etc. It turns out they knocked him out and they pumped him full of Borg implants and new Borg technology, and sort of ruined his intelligence and ruined his mind and made him into just this. He wasn't a genius anymore. He was just sort of this, almost like the Hulk. I felt like he had some sort of nanoprobes or whatever running through his blood with all that new morphing power, that he felt angry all the time. You know, he couldn't think straight. And that was really hard to accept. The new Icheb was hard to accept because the old one was really intelligent, and every line that they wrote for him, every line that was written, he had big words and great dialogue, and he spoke with a great vocabulary. And in the new film, there were a lot of lines that I fought, and I just went to Tim Russ and I said, look, Icheb would never say this. He would never talk that dumb. He wouldn't say that. And Tim would look at the script and he'd go, yeah, man, you wouldn't. And so we'd try to think about something to write instead. And if we couldn't come up with it, I spend a lot of time going, can I just say nothing and look cool? And Tim would go, yeah, just say nothing. And so we ended up cutting a lot of Icheb's dialogue. Just like a spoiled actor in the second one, I'm hoping that whoever writes it watches the Voyager episodes and knows the character that they're writing, so that we can hear a little bit more. In Renegades, Icheb looks great. The arm cannon's cool. He's neat to look at, but he doesn't say much, and we don't find out much about who he is or what he's become. And I'd like there to be a little more dialogue in the second one, just to find out about what kind of man he's become. We know he's angry and we know that he's been screwed around by some bad people, but we don't know if his heart's still there. And I'd like to know that.
You know, Manu, one of the things we wanted to ask you about was, you know, with any actor and with any role, we figure that there's a kind of an overlap. There's parts of you bring into each ep and maybe some things you've taken away from each ep. But you mentioned earlier that there's this notion that as you get older, as you have more experiences, more challenges, you constantly circle back. Sometimes Star Trek is your friend. Sometimes it's not. Sometimes you love it. Sometimes you hate being a part of it. You know, like any life, you go through progressions, right? You know, for you right now, where you're at, given that Star Trek is part of your life, it's going to be for a long time to come, what issues do you have now that you find are particularly interesting or particularly salient? What kinds of directions would you like to see Star Trek go in? It occurred to me that as I was thinking about Renegades, that there's a proliferation of fan-made Star Trek movies, you know, to various degrees of quality, various budgets and whatnot. All of them are taking Star Trek in a different direction than sort of the canonical Star Trek, the official quote-unquote Star Trek that comes out of Paramount and CBS.
Whatever that is.
Yeah. Whatever that is, right? Exactly. But that says to me that there's kind of a need, a desire, direction that fans would like to see Star Trek go that's not being met in the official Star Trek channels. But so kind of combine those two questions, you know, where are you at in your life now? What issues do you find particularly interesting, and where would you like to see Star Trek go in the future, either in Renegades or in the next Star Trek series coming out next year, all the above?
I am honestly, let's answer this with actually some thought. I am a big fan of what JJ did with the franchise. So I know there's half of the folks out there, usually the younger folks, love the new JJ stuff. And usually the older guys want the more thought-provoking Star Trek of the original cast. I thought that JJ did this wonderful thing where he made it an action, fun space. And, you know, originally, what I have to say to those guys is that it was, from the very beginning, Wagon Train to the Stars. It was Cowboys in Space. So we can't forget that part, you know? And I still think his movies had heart. In fact, the second film made me cry twice. That's just me. Other people think it's missing the heart. For me, personally, I just want it to be, it would be nice, I guess, and it would be brilliant, and it would be so hard for it to be even possible, but it would be nice to bring those two camps together somehow. I have always found it strange that you can call yourself a Star Trek fan and then bash a Star Trek film so hard. It never has made sense to me, because I've always been like, hey, even the bad films are pretty good. They're still stars. They're still Star Trek, right? But it would be neat if maybe those warring camps, if this new TV version, the new CBS version, could bring back that Twilight Zone really intelligent quality to some of the episodes, and at the same time, keep the fun, action-y stuff that keeps us hooked and on the edge of our seats. And that's a really hard thing to do creatively. That's a really hard thing to put on anybody's shoulders. I think they hired the right guys in Kurtzman and Fuller and Roddenberry. And I think they made I think if anybody's going to do it right, it's going to be those guys. So I'm excited to see what they come up with. That's what I would try to do, is I would try to make both people happy and see if I could possibly pull that off. And I imagine that Brian Fuller, the guy's smart. He's a really good writer. So I think he's going to surprise us, and we're going to enjoy it. It's funny because I had never really seen the original series. And just recently I decided, you've been going around talking about Star Trek for 15 years. You might as well watch more than the films and see some of the original episodes. So I started watching some of the original stuff with my girlfriend, who's a huge Star Trek fan. And I can find arguments for everybody's stuff. You know, there's that episode right in the beginning. I think it's like episode 6 or something, where Kirk kills the last of its kind, this salt creature that's drinking people's And he doesn't really feel bad about it. You know, he kills the last tiger on Earth, basically. But then we've given this guy this reputation for being this humanitarian that, you know, he's all about good and a positive future with enlightened people. And I think a little bit of that is bull. I think everybody was imperfect, and Star Trek is imperfect, and humanity is imperfect. And there's these episodes that just, you know, that's what I find so great about film, is it shows us, good film, is it shows us what we are, which is a completely imperfect species that's capable of so much love and sacrifice and honor, and at the same time we're capable of so much deviant, backstabbing, idiotic behavior. War and peace, you know.
So given that, how do you combine the best of human nature and the worst of human nature together into a drama that is still optimistic? I mean, Star Trek has that optimism that draws the fans in. How do you walk that line between holding onto that optimism and incorporating, you know, showing the worst of human nature for what it is, but showing that we can transcend it at the same time?
Yeah, it thank God for good writers. You know, I've written a few screenplays myself, and that's a really hard thing to do. It starts with good writing, and I think they picked the right guys to write. So I don't think we'll be disappointed. I don't know what the budget for the show is. That's another thing. I produced a movie called Fifth Passenger recently that's still in post-production. I think we made a really beautiful thing, but the amount of favors that I had to pull from, that everybody involved had to pull from all departments to make that movie for as cheap as we made it and have it look like it's looking, is also a question. How much is Paramount investing in every episode? I don't know the answer to that. I hope it's a lot, because it's really hard to do good space drama without money. But when I first felt let down by Renegades, I had to, and then I rewatched it 4 months later when it was finished and ready, I had to give them props. I was like, how did they pull this off for $300,000? That's an amazing thing to do. And Fifth Passenger is right around the same area. And I'm hoping the new Star Trek has more like, you know, $1.5 million or 2 million an episode, so that they can really, really show us some magic. I started rambling again. I forgot the question. It happens to me a lot.
Yeah, I think it was just a question about, you know, how as a writer, as a producer.
Do you put those two?
Yeah, how do you put the two together? Exactly.
That's drama. Ask Shakespeare. I don't know. I just, I hire good writers.
Zachary and I have actually been campaigning to join the writing team of the new Trek using the hashtag Mike and Zach Write Trek. So I know where they could find a couple of writers for, you know, a reasonable and equitable amount.
Do you have some screenplays?
No, I don't.
No, we're just traveling philosophers for hire right now. So
I do write, just not screenplays.
I mean, that's what I've turned my Star Trek experience into. And that's... you say, where am I at now? I'm making my new film, The Circuit. And this is not, this is just, I'm not trying to actually even, what's it called when you promote something? Promote. But it goes right along with what we're talking about. For me, the convention scene has been such a crazy experience to grow up in the Star Trek family and the Star Trek world. I've been all over the world, and I've seen some really strange things behind the scenes at these conventions. I don't think the fan base really knows what goes on behind the velvet curtain at these places. I think some people would be completely shocked, and I think some of the actors would be completely shocked by some of the lives the fans are living and the stories that are happening to the fans. And I've been working on this project for like 6 years, and I decided to make, because I've lived it for so long, you write what you live and you got to make art out of what you live. I figured, let's tell this multi-genre story where conventions are places, Star Trek conventions, science fiction conventions, are places where people gather to celebrate genre entertainment, horror, sci-fi, fantasy, supernatural, etc. So what a perfect backdrop to tell tales from all those different genres and use an entertainment convention as a place to tell a bunch of different broad-based big stories. So the circuit is sort of a way for me to show people some of the experiences behind the scenes living this life that, like you said, some of you guys are, we want to know about it. We want to know what goes on back there. And at the same time, also tell some incredible stories like Star Trek's. The thing I love about Star Trek is when you get those self-contained episodes that are just a story unto themselves, and it's like a Twilight Zone type of quality. And so what I want the circuit to be is basically like Galaxy Quest meets Twilight Zone. You know, we want a bunch of actors playing themselves in weird situations, and maybe, you know, something a little bit weird is going on at this convention that isn't happening at others. So I think I found a way to make a great anthology film that makes fun of all of us, that shows how beautiful all of us are, and at the same time tells great genre-based stories with the backdrop being a place where we all go to hang out to celebrate those genre-based stories. So it's going to be sort of a film within a film within a film.
And Manu, did I see that you have an open submission policy? People are submitting script ideas, or whether fully fleshed out scripts or script concepts. I think I saw that on your Facebook page for this.
Yeah, we have the beginning, a middle, and an end of a fantastic screenplay written by some fantastic writers, James Byrd being one of them. I'm talking to Jackson Stewart, who wrote for Supernatural. I'm talking to Carlos de los Rios right now, who wrote Diablo, this new film with Scott Eastwood and Walton Goggins. Scott Baker, who wrote The Fifth Passenger, is going to write for it. I'm going to write for it. And we have this great skeleton, the beginning, middle, and an end. And I realized that when I was standing on stage in FedCon a year ago, and there was like 7,500 people out there in front of me, and they were all clapping. And in Germany, they do a really big, spectacular thing with their conventions. There's lights and loud music, and you can see the audience from all the lights and pyrotechnics and et cetera. And I started looking around the audience, and I made eye contact with all these fans that had shared their life stories with me over the weekend. And I realized, oh my God, look at all the stories out there. I'm missing that. You know, I wanted to make a movie about the convention scene, but I was missing 90% of it, which is the fans. And I had all these great moments over that weekend with all these great people. And I started pegging them out of the crowd and sort of giving them the knowing nod that we'd shared something together. And I realized that for this film to be whole, it not only has to be sci-fi and fantasy and multi-genre, but it has to have a couple of dramas in it. It has to have a couple of comedies in it. It has to have a couple of human stories that keep it from being just, a Tales from the Crypt type of film where it's just all splatter and heartless. So the basic open submission policy to the fans, we're going to release the website next month, but the basic rules are you pick the genre. It has to happen. The episode or the segment of the film has to happen over the weekend of a sci-fi convention sometime, or a pop culture convention. Could be a brony convention. Doesn't matter. Any kind of convention that's pop culture. But it has to take place over the weekend of a pop culture convention. It has to be 1 to 20 pages in length, or just a story treatment, great breakdown for a story, which is just a one page treatment of this would make a great story. We're also asking people just to send in little funny things, that moments from conventions, because we want to get in as many you know, funny little things that have happened to people. I can think of a million funny little moments, you know, that have happened at a convention that I would love to get on a film. Like, you know, when there's the hot actress from whatever sci-fi show is taking her photo op, and there's the nervous fan standing next to her.
Yeah, there's none of those in Voyager, right?
None of those. Like, I didn't deal with that myself for 2 years, 21 years old, working with Jerry Ryan. Oh, it's awful. So, you know, the arm starts up around the shoulder, and they kind of hover, or, like, they don't want to touch her. And then the actress feels bad for the fan, and so they're like, hey, it's okay, go ahead. And then the hand gets on the shoulder, and it, and the photographer's messing around, and then slowly the hand's on the waist, and then it's getting a little bit too uncomfortable for the actress. And there's all those kind of lovely things that happen at conventions that I want to get in there. So anything you've seen that you think should make a movie, I even have a bathroom story that's just so awful, it has to be in the film. It's just got to be in the film.
I was going to ask, is there anything you can, I mean, what's the craziest, wackiest, without giving away something from the movie, of course, is there, what's the craziest, wackiest story you've got that you can share with us here?
God, that's, I don't want to share anything because it's all so good. I want to keep it, I want to keep it all a secret until we show you this thing, because it's, it's going to be the most epic experimental filmmaking, because we're going to tell human stories, but we're also going to tell completely crazy genre stories, and we're going to tell them all with the convention backdrop. And I don't want to share anything because I don't want to give up any of the gold that we might use. Maybe next time when we've gone into production and some of the stuff I decide not to use, I'll share, like the arm thing. Now I can't use the arm thing, you know. That happens to every single actress. I've heard that story I don't know how many times, where it starts off like they're way too uncomfortable, and by the end of the thing, it's down on her hip.
So Manu, we've talked a good bit about Star Trek. We've talked about Voyager and Icheb, Uncle Manu's cool arm cannon. We hit that one. And of course, your current projects as well. We were talking just before we started the interview about the difference between being an actor and a producer. I thought it would be really interesting to kind of catch the spirit of that conversation before we began, and just touch on the experience of producing as opposed to acting before we wrap up today.
Is that a question?
That is a question. What's the difference between your experience as an actor, and now you've got actually several projects. You've got Fifth Passenger. You've got The Circuit, which, by the way, has a phenomenal cast attached to it. Other projects that I know you've been working on, both as an actor and as a producer. What's the difference for you, at least, between the two roles?
There's a gigantic difference. And the hardest part is to put the producer hat aside when you go to finally get to production, because producing means literally everything. And a lot of people that are outside the film industry that just watch movies, you cannot understand how difficult it really is to make a film until you try to put all the pieces together. You've got to rent the right camera. You've got to hire the right director of photography. He's got to hire the right team. He has to hire the right gaffer, which is the person responsible for lighting every scene and lighting every set. And the camera settings have to be set right. And the makeup has to be done right. And you have to hire the right actors and the right writers and the right script and the right prop. And the makeup trucks and the crew trucks have to be there on time. And the catering has to be there. And you have to keep your actors happy. And you have to have the right food on set, the right snacks. Because sometimes you have famous actors that want their little thing. And if it's not there, then they get in a bad mood. And then they give you a bad performance. And those are just a few of the things. You have to get locations. You have to go to the city and get the permit to shoot on the bridge and have it closed from 4 to 6. And earlier that day, you're shooting over on a beach and you have to crew move and get over to the bridge because you only have the permit to shoot with the helicopter at that bridge from 4 to 6. And then when you get there, you have to drop all of that, get into character, and forget about everything but the performance in the movie that you're doing. So that is, it's an incredibly hard thing to do. And my first film that I produced is called Benjamin Troubles. It's on, you can go to www.bentroubles.com and see the trailer. It's on the festival circuit right now. It's playing around America. It'll be in Manhattan soon, then Niagara Falls, Atlantic City, then back in LA for a couple weeks until it gets its distribution, it gets out. Then Fifth Passenger will be along behind that. And then this year we're doing the circuit. But the difference is just, it's so much more work. And if you make a good film, it's so much more satisfying. And if you make a bad film, or even a, you know, I'm a perfectionist. I want to see great film, and I want to make great film. So when I make a film that's just okay, that's just cute, that's just, hey, that was pretty good, that was all right, that makes me angry. But when you do it right, and I think with Fifth Passenger, we've done it right. I'm really proud of the work we did on that film. And I'm hoping the circuit is going to be the same thing. It's just the difference in, you know, if you sow the field and you make, you put all the effort in, the tomato tastes so much better than if you go buy it at the supermarket, I guess, you know. You've done everything. And it's on your shoulders at that point. As an actor, you can always blame it on somebody else if the episode or the project is bad. But as a producer, it's your fault if it's bad. Even if it's not, you know, even if it's somebody else's, you hired them. So that's the big difference. It's just the sheer amount of work. While we're here, can I just explain the circuit a little bit more?
Absolutely. We'd love for you to.
So it's an anthology film like VHS. If you think of some of the great anthology films, Four Rooms, Sin City, Pulp Fiction, Coffee and Cigarettes, Monty Python's The Meaning of Life, Creepshow. Usually in an anthology film, you stick to one genre. But in our film, we're not going to be committed to that. We're going to tell all the genres, and then we're going to have a story behind those stories that connects the whole thing together. And our stories, like I said, will take place over the weekend of a pop culture convention. Some of the stories will be true stories, and some of the stories will be based on absolute fiction. And it'll be up to the audience to sort of decide, maybe. I think we'll leave some sort of vague, is this true or isn't it? I think that'll be a part of the fun part of watching it in the end. And we're asking the fans that decide to submit their stories to think Galaxy Quest meets Twilight Zone meets Steven Spielberg's amazing stories, and to just get creative, you know. People always say, hey, when I pitch this to people, they go, what's a convention story? I went to a convention, I bought a hot dog, I sat next to Walter Koenig and got a picture, and then I went, tell a great story. There's amazing things that happen at these shows. I've people have met the loves of their lives and then got married the next year at them. But then you could also go off to Crazyville and go in your hotel room at midnight and find a magic porthole into Ethan Phillips' brain. You know, we want to tell crazy, fun stories, you know. Just maybe you take control of his body, or a brain swap story, you know, where something magic happens where a fan swaps a body with Shatner or something, and they're stuck in the wrong bodies, you know. We thought, to give a little bit away, we have a good idea that we're thinking about writing. Oh, I don't want to give this away. I'll just tell you that we have a zombie story that we thought it would be. Oh, I don't want to give this away.
Yeah, you don't have to give it away.
It's a zombie story, but it's so good.
Well, our listeners heard it here first. Zombie story in the circuit.
Yeah.
There's the scoop.
I've got to say, Manu, I'm really excited about the circuit. I hadn't been clued into what you were working on until recently, until Mike told me you wanted to join us on the show here. But it seems like your intuitions and my intuitions match up. I love episodic television, whether in Star Trek. I grew up watching The Twilight Zone. I love crazy, small stories that make you think, that capture those human moments. And Yeah, and film can be stuck in a real rut. You know, film after film after film comes out in the box office, and you know, they're not the kind of experimental, you know, sort of small picture, small moments, interesting ideas. That experimental aspect is something that's really missing. I'm glad you're doing it. I'm really excited.
And the reason it's missing is because it's very complicated to do right, and the studios, you know, to do a Twilight Zone anthology or Twilight Zone the film part two or. There's actually a great episodic, their only rule is that it has to be sci-fi, and it's called Black Mirror. Have you guys seen Black Mirror yet?
No, I haven't seen that one.
Go to Netflix, watch Black Mirror. You will be stoked. It's fantastic. You know, it's their rule is it's they're all self-contained stories. It's a new actors every time, but, it just has to be sci-fi, and it's a sci-fi Twilight Zone, basically. It's so good. It's an English show on Netflix. And we're striving to do, you know, something like that. Oh, and I didn't mention my cast either. Well, I'm not going to. You guys can go to the Facebook page. I was just about to read everybody involved in the project, and I've only announced like 8 actors, and we have like 30 plus. So.
Oh, wow.
You know, I had a small list written down here. If you want to read the list, we'd be more than happy to.
Yeah, you can read the list of the people we've announced so far, and maybe I'll throw one more in the mix.
So the list I've got here, I've got Nana Visitor, Mindy Robinson, Cody Saint-Gnu. Am I pronouncing that right?
Saint-Gnu. Teen Wolf.
I wasn't familiar with him. Robert Beltran, of course, from Voyager. Terry Farrell, Jadzia Dax on Deep Space Nine. Ethan Phillips, Armin Shimerman. Everyone knows these names, right? How about Bini Lube? Am I pronouncing that right?
Oh, no, she's just a fan. She's a fantastic fan.
Well, she got a shout out here today.
She threw up the symbol for us. We asked the fans to throw out symbols. We've been collecting pictures to make a big collage.
It made it a little hard to know who was an actor and who was a fan.
Yeah. Armin Shimerman, did you say? I know we announced Armin. We announced Gigi Edgley from Farscape. I think we even announced J.G. Hertzler for one short moment there. He's still in it. I'll give you Doug Jones as your new person. But we have people from Game of Thrones. We have people from Defiance. We have people from Arrow. We have people from Teen Wolf. We have people from all the great shows that span sci-fi, fantasy, horror, and superhero. And we're going to mix them all up in a big bowl and make a kick-ass movie.
Right. So just to be clear, this isn't just about Star Trek conventions. This is about sci-fi, fantasy, you name it.
Pop culture.
Yes, pop culture conventions of any kind in the past, present, or future. That's the only rule. And so, of course, you're going to have a time travel story in there, too, if you think hard enough about it. Because we're going to be doing genre stories. This convention could take place in the 70s, and then another convention could take place in 3050. And we have to tie it all together in one story. So we figured out how to do that. Now it's just up to the fans to submit their stories. And so, that's one thing I didn't mention is that if you get your story selected, you get to come to set and work as story editor, and we'll fly you out and you'll get to work on the crew. And there's also, that's another thing about the campaign when we launch is everybody that contributes to the circuit will be allowed to put their name into a hat, basically into an internet hat, to come and work in one of the departments of the of your choosing, whether you're interested in special effects or makeup or directing or acting or etc. There's, you know, 30 key departments in film, and we're going to select for each segment of the film one fan for every department is going to get to come work on the film. So it's going to be the most collaborative celebrity and fan feature film ever made is in the history of Hollywood. Is sort of something that's never, from what I know, the research I've been able to do, is something that's never been done before. So it's pretty exciting.
I like that it's very inclusive, you know, breaking down the barriers between fan and celebrity, between producer and writer and contributor. It's incredibly collaborative, and it's atypical.
I think it would be fun to also in the episodes to, I really like that idea. It's not written yet. We don't have that story yet. Maybe someone can take a swing at it of the brain swap of, fans swapping brains with the celebrities and they're stuck in the opposite bodies for the weekend and have to figure their way out.
Are you saying you want to host Metatrex next week?
Yeah, sure. Why not?
We'll sign you up.
Well, Monty, you mentioned the Facebook page. What are other places? What's the best place, really, for our listeners to follow you and your projects?
The best place now is to go to www.facebook.com/thecircuitmovie. On Instagram and Twitter, we just got that stuff up. There's almost no information on those sites as of yet, but we encourage people to follow them. There will be. It's at The Circuit Movie on Twitter and Instagram. And next month, the website will launch, and you'll get a lot more content and a lot more concept, et cetera, when we launch the website. And that will be www.thecircuitfilm.com. So all the other sites are The Circuit Movie, and the website is The Circuit Film.
And they can find out there how to submit scripts for the project?
They'll be able to find out on the website. I encourage people to start writing now. Once again, just to go over it, the rules are 1 to 20 pages or just a one-page breakdown. You can submit in screenplay format or short story format, depending on what kind of writer you are. And just start writing. It has to be original material. And that's really the only rule. It has to take place over the weekend of a pop culture convention. Next month, we'll submit the email to start submitting stories. I mean, we'll announce the email. But you could probably guess it if you wanted to submit early.
And how about you personally? What's the best way for our listeners to interact with you out on social media?
Yeah, you can find me at www.facebook.com/ManuNteRayme123. I'm also, that's really the best place to find me. I'm also on Twitter at ManuNteRayme. I follow everybody that asks me to follow them back, and I interact. There are a couple people that work on my fan page, but I read every single message that comes into me personally. The messages, and if you're not talking to me, you're talking to my girlfriend, and she'll tell you that it's her. So, but that's the easiest way to get a message to me and get a response is go to my Facebook writer director page.
Cool. Well, I know you've been very responsive to messages from me, and you've been incredibly generous with your time today. We really appreciate you joining us here on Metatrex on Trek.fm Network.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
So I wanted to thank you as well for taking the time to join us. You know, it's a privilege to get to interview someone who's been on Star Trek, of course, the show that I know and love. And like I said, you're not your character, but I've seen you on screen more times than I can count. But is there any sort of final thoughts, anything you want our listeners to know about, you know, you, the person versus Icheb, the character?
Well, yeah, you know, I get in trouble a lot when I go to conventions because Icheb was, especially the Voyager Icheb, the official Icheb, the CBS Icheb, was such a intelligent, perfect human being / Borg. You know, he was really sweet, and he had such a big heart. And so I think sometimes when people go to shows, they forget that I'm a 38-year-old man. And I've gotten in such trouble because the rule has been placed on me that for some people at least, most people just accept me for who I am, but you know, I'm sort of an edgy person. I have hard opinions and I cuss a lot. And, you know, I was raised by hippies. My name's ManuNteRayme. So, and I'm an Irish guy, you know, so.
And you wear better hats than Icheb did.
Yeah, I mean, the funny thing is, strange how life takes us. You know, it's the character I'm known for most, but I am also a lot like that guy if you mix the two worlds that we've seen of him together. You know, the angry Icheb and I kind of switch back and forth between the renegades Icheb that's given up on our species and just can't stand this planet any longer. And other times I'm the cup is half full. We can do this, guys. Let's hang on. Maybe there's a, you know, I watched Tomorrowland yesterday and found myself just totally fascinated by it. And in the end, it was the whole idea that dreamers have to stick together, and the people that believe that this planet can go on and that we can learn how to stop fighting and that we can, you know, all these dreams that a cynic would say, yeah, that's never going to happen. We're just going to blow up and it's all going to be over. So, and eventually an asteroid's going to hit us anyway. But, you know, but I was so touched by Tomorrowland, right? And I hate Disney, usually. But, you know, so I float back and forth between a complete optimist full of hope and a cynic full of just despair. And, you know, maybe I'm bipolar. I don't know.
Well, who's winning out this week?
This week, I'm right down the middle. Right down the middle, you know. It's a coin flip, man. Human, you know, this whole story that we're all sitting here writing together is pretty crazy. Yeah. You're going to get me started and I'm just going to keep going, you know.
It's okay. I find myself captivated by that change in life. Every day I wake up, I'm a different person in a different mood. Different things are on my mind. Every week is different. Every year is different. There are these phases to life and it's complicated. And, you know, it's not just a matter of, I guess, how do you keep that optimism despite that? How do you fight it back?
Well, as an American, we're so spoiled. We are so spoiled. And look at us. We're three white guys in America too. Mm-hmm. Like, come on, quit whining. It's a really hard, cold world out there, right? Mm-hmm. There are places that are war-torn and people are starving. And I always think about that when I think my life's difficult. I go, stop it. It could be so much worse. We have the ability in this country. Even the poor are relatively... Yeah, I'm poor. I don't know about you guys. I don't know if you guys are rich guys. You know, 99% of us are poor, right? 1% have all the money. So, but even us, we have a roof over our head and a microwave and a fridge and a Mac and an iPhone and a car and a, you know. So, life is not that hard. That's how I keep the optimism in that.
Well, let me ask you one more question. What you know, you're an artist and a creative, as are we in our own ways. I think a lot of the people involved in Trek FM and a lot of our listeners are creatives in their own way. Most people are creative in their own way. Everyone's got their way of doing it. What role does maybe film in particular, but art in general play in helping solve those third world problems? You know, the poverty and the war and is there a role that you see your own work playing in that larger context?
Well, I'll tell you the reason that I act, that I've always acted, and I don't know if I knew it when I was a young man, when I was a kid acting and stuff, but I know I've come to know it. I look around the world and I see a complete lack of empathy in our mm-hmm. species, and I think great films, when you see a really, really great film about a life experience, you might be watching something on the screen about people that you cannot relate to whatsoever. You've not lived their life. You've not been through the experiences that they're experiencing, but you're touched by them and they touch your heart and they make you realize that we actually, how we started the show off, right? We are all human beings going through this amazing struggle called life. And I act so that I can tell other people's stories. And I hope that when you do good work and you make a movie that really, really shows somebody else's life and their journey, that you spread empathy and you build it in other people. I've walked out of so many good films that had a positive message in them of some type, even if it wasn't a positive message, even if it was a film about struggle, I walk out going, God, we got to do something about that. And, I don't think that being an actor, you know, solves third world problems, but I think that the next time that you're in the third world, if you've just watched a good movie, you might be more generous while you're there. And what's crazy to me too, is I just watched a movie called Happiness. It seems the most depressed people on this planet are the people that have it the best off. The film's whole thing was a documentary, and it was showing all these families in the third world that have it really simple. They just work all day. They take care of their kids. They live in where they live. They work and they eat, and they are happy. And a lot of us who have it really, really well off are dealing with all sorts of mental, you know, there's a mental illness in this country that's widespread, that we all fight, or a lot of us do at least. So it was a really sort of interesting thought too, is just, you know, it doesn't, you know, having a bunch of money in a house and hoarding it all for yourself is not necessarily going to give you happiness. In fact, most likely will make you miserable.
You know, it's funny you mentioned that. I work in San Francisco 3 days a week, and you know, there's more money going on there right now because of the resurgence of the tech industry and whatnot in the Bay Area. And I walk around and I see people, they barely acknowledge each other. They're not happy. They're angsty, in a bad mood. And you know, there's this cloud hanging over the entire environment, despite the riches and the wealth and the you know, all the virtues they've got. You know, they don't, it doesn't seem like a happy place to be. It's sad to see, just given how successful everyone looks on the surface.
Yeah, when you get to the rich part of San Francisco and you start hanging out with the upper crusties and the techies and the, what was it, what's that hill called? I loved living in San Francisco. I lived there for a couple of years back when I was like 26 27. And that's also in your head too, right? Whether there's a cloud hanging over things. It's all a perspective thing, you know. Yeah. You really do, you know, it's really all what's coming out of here, not what's coming out of there. But it seems, yeah, it's, you know, that my experience, the more that I've gotten into a look at the upper crusty, really, really, really rich society, there's all these rules and regulations and social acceptances that you have to follow in order to hang in that crowd. And I find it all really ridiculous, and it seems maddening. It seems crazy. You know, I dated a really rich girl for a while, and the customs that I had to follow and the way I had to tuck in my shirt and wear my tie and et cetera and behave during dinner, and just, what's going on? What is this? You know? Couldn't do it.
Well, if I had to guess, it doesn't seem like you're big on rules.
No, I'm not. I think that the only rule that should be in existence is it don't hurt each other. That's it. If you're not hurting someone else, I don't think there should be a rule against it. If you can actually prove that you're causing harm to some other person, then there should be a rule. Otherwise, ugh, too many of them. We make so many laws against so many things. It's incredible. If you've ever actually, I don't know what, you're in San Francisco, right? Get the code book, get the California state law code book sometime and just flip it open. You can be arrested for literally anything. There are so many laws in there. Talking too loud is a jailable offense in California. If you go into a restaurant and you go up to somebody and you go, man, you know, this day sucks and you suck, you can be arrested for that.
I better be careful how loud I play my Trek FM podcast on the way home from work.
Yeah, you know, the noise complaints. Come on, put in some earplugs. Go to bed.
Well, you know, I think you're right. The world is full of problems, and you know, what it's always nice to see is when people come together. You know, it happens in times of crisis. It happens in times of art. Happens, you know, it happens in the environment you're describing in the circuit. You know, in the convention circuit, people come together in ways you don't realize that are happening around you. It happens every day on the street. You know, there's this whole world of experience out there that's begging to be captured. It's almost this philosophical, phenomenological perspectivism, you know, that what matters in reality is not this, you know, overarching, you know, philosophy or overarching worldview. It's not part of being part of a particular country or a nation. What matters is this little world of experience and the way that those experiences can bind people together. And, you know, can it solve third world problems? Maybe not, but at least it could make it a better place where people are more empathetic. I think you're right that empathy is a big key. It's sad to see the death of empathy in the world.
Yeah, and we need to start from a basic level of like in schools of teaching people instead of competition based stuff, like teamwork based stuff, because life works so much better when you have a good team of friends around each other working towards a purpose and you're not just trying to get it all for yourself. And I think we're taught in America and in a lot of Western countries from the beginning, it's subliminally even, is get the best car, get the best house, make the most money and blah, blah, blah. And it's not about that. And I think the third world knows that. So if we could somehow mesh the two worlds together, you know, that would be the dream, right? But,
I think you're right, because on the one hand, you know, you want enough of a top dog attitude where you force yourself to go out in the world and do things. You want to challenge yourself. You don't want to be stagnant, right? So, you know, the Western world seems to have that down pretty well. You know, we get out in the world, we do things, we invent things and make things happen for ourselves. But what's lost is the responsibility to community, the connections with others, the sort of underlying communalism that can bind society together. You don't want to be so top dog that you're heartless, that you trample on other people. And it is a matter of just finding the natural middle ground between those two opposing ways of being.
Yeah, and that's what I'm interested in this life, at least, is finding that and helping spread whatever that is. And I'm not a smart man, but I know what a box of chocolate is or whatever the hell. I do know that empathy is important, and so that's just what I try to do with acting and film is tell people stories so that we can feel each other. And really good movies make you feel connected to each other. So.
Well, we really appreciate you taking the time to join us, Manu. You know, we hope to have you back sometime. Maybe when the circuit's a little farther along, we can have you back. And
absolutely,
yeah, really appreciate your time.
All right, guys, thank you.
Thanks. You have a great evening.
Manu, thank you so much.
Bye bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, Mike, that was a really fun and interesting discussion with Manu, and I'm amazed. I don't think he could be inauthentic if he tried.
Oh, that was a fantastic discussion. And the really great thing, he's just so candid, and I just really appreciate it. I can't say enough how generous he was with his time. Just appreciated him taking the time to talk to us, not just about Star Trek, but about his other projects and his thoughts on the country and the world we live in today.
Yeah, I really appreciated the way he opened up to us and opened up about his time on Voyager, both the good and the bad, and his perspective in life now. And he, you know, he really treated us like equals, and it was nice to. He mentioned during his interview that he's a fan of empathy. He thinks people need to empathize with each other more, and he was empathetic with us and treated us very much like equals. And I appreciated the time he gave us and the great discussion we had with him.
Oh, I agree completely.
And hopefully we can have him back after they're a little farther along in the circuit. So again, if you're listening to this and you're interested in following Manu's project, go to facebook.com/thecircuitmovie and you can follow all the news on the circuit project there. It seems like a fascinating project. Like I said, I love episodic storytelling. I love experimental film. I love those small human moments. I think they're going to produce something really interesting and great.
Yeah, I just actually started working on a writing project, but I may have to pause and maybe put something together to send to him for that. It sounds like a fun project he's working on. I'm stoked about it.
Yeah, listening to him talk, I've got a couple of crazy ideas myself I'm probably gonna throw over there. Inspired by philosophy, questionably.
Okay. Sounds.
So we'll see. It can be a Metatrex competition. Which one of our stories ends up in the circuit? You never know what's going to come of it, right? You know, that's what's amazing about these open submission policies, right? They're soliciting scripts and story ideas from potential fans from the world at large. And look at what that can lead to. I mean, Brian Fuller, who's going to be spearheading the Star Trek 2017 show, got his start writing for Voyager through an open submission policy. And mm-hmm. Now he's running the entire franchise. And you know, you just never know where those kinds of things can lead. And I'll take an idea and throw it out there and see what happens, you know, roll the dice, so to speak.
I'm interested in that Ethan Phillips brain swap story.
Well, you know, that's the low-hanging fruit. I got to come up with a more original idea than that one, right?
Indeed.
Well, interviewing former Borg children isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week. So here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
You've heard Chief Tripp sign on. I'm serious, Ken. Actually, out of the chair, please. Okay, okay. God.
I guess the Commodore has the con!
Earl Grey.
Did you really write down Groppler Zorn on this list?
I was just kidding.
This is before he achieved Groppler rank.
He was only a Soplar. He wasn't a Groppler that.
What fruit did he like before he got to apples?
The orb.
I want to hear Worf give a command sometime, like 1/4 ramming speed. And then yes. Someone says, Captain, regulation specifically states that we cannot go at 1/4 ramming speed while we are in orbit of a planet.
The ready room.
To what extent is this episode, the writers and producers of Deep Space Nine turning the mirror back at the fans? You know, I mean, I think all of us Star Trek fans at one point or another probably retreat into this universe we love, Star Trek, that is, it's a fictional world.
What are you talking about, Zachary? Are you suggesting that, like, fans might decide to buy microphones and, like, talk about it like it's real for hours on end?
To the journey!
Next one in line is Spirit Folk, and we already agreed that that is just not necessary for anybody, and let's not torture them with it. Good, let's move on.
The characters in the Fairhaven Hollow program begin to suspect the Voyager crew after they witness several supernatural occurrences. Commentary, Trek Stars.
Tokyo Drift really is the perfect subtitle. Like, you could literally put Tokyo Drift onto the end of any movie, and it would instantaneously become a movie that you would have to see. Citizen Kane, Tokyo Drift.
The 602 Club.
I hate it when shows that are grounded in reality, but obviously they're not, and they have their characters go through socially important experiences.
Literary Treks.
It is very much every one of the characters, you know, who finds themselves sort of pulled into the conflict that's the heart of this story. They are reacting to a fear of the other.
Meta Trex.
I'd love to answer your question, but I can't get the visual image out of my mind of B. Arthur and Betty White in Starfleet miniskirts and go-go boots.
I can totally picture the Golden Girls as Klingons.
Melodic Trex.
What I decided to do was not only would I pick a 6 degree of separation, not only would I do it musically, but I was only going to do movies that were composed by people who had composed for Star Trek.
Saturday Morning Trek.
Dorothy had a little bit of a fit with the animators. They had said over and over again, there is no moon in the Vulcan sky.
I think it was like the first episode that aired of the original series when they mentioned this, because Uhura walks up to Spock and she's like, tell me I'm beautiful. Tell me that I would look good in your moon. And he's like, Vulcan has no moon.
I'm not surprised.
That is an uncanny Uhura.
Continuing mission.
Yeah, and of course, another great thing is when it's all finished and you look at it and go, yeah, we made that together. Yeah, that's one of the greatest moments. And people respond to it and say, oh, that's pretty well made. The effects are great. The actors are great, even though they're Dutch trying to speak English, right?
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly and makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. Another way you can help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all of the great perks we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats in our content development team, and many more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And don't forget to check out Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society that will design and launch an 8-foot orbiter and return the craft to Earth. The NSS Enterprise Orbiter will carry more than 100 student-designed science experiments into space, and you can help make it happen. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. If you'd like to contact us with feedback or suggestions for the show, or to send us your thoughts on anything we discussed in this episode of MetaTreks, you can contact us in several different ways. You can contact us via a form on Trek FM's website. Just go to trek.fm/contact.
You can also leave us a voicemail. Look in the sidebar on the show page, or go to speakpipe.com/trekfm.
On Twitter, our handle is just @trekfm.
And you can also find us on Facebook. It's facebook.com/trekfm. While you're there, check out our listeners-only discussion group, the Babel Conference. Type the Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, or go to our website at trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar.
We also invite you to leave a rating and a review of MetaTreks on iTunes. We'd love to hear your feedback and suggestions for the show. Well, Mike, when you're not running away from Uncle Manu's cool arm cannon, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network?
Well, Zachary, I'm always on the Babel Conference, Facebook, obviously. Also Twitter, my handle is @cmichael1701. You can also find me on Instagram, cmichael1701. And Zachary, when you're not participating in awkward photo ops at conventions, where can our listeners find you around the interwebs?
Well, you can find me in the Babel Conference, Trek FM's listeners group, if you want to talk Star Trek and philosophy with me there. You can also find me on several recent episodes of The Ready Room, Trek FM's flagship podcast. And you can find me on Twitter. My handle there is just my name, Zachary Fruhling. That's ZachariFruhling. We'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the MetaTreks team from the network, specifically C. Brian Jones, founder and publisher of Trek.fm, our executive producers, Charlene Schmidt, Matthew Rushing, and Norman Lau, Aaron Harvey, our art director, Will Wynn, our content manager, Richard Marquez, our production manager, and Dennis Costello, our editor and producer. And Mike, I should say that we have a brand new credit to give this week. We have a new associate producer here for MetaTreks named Patrick Devlin.
Well, Patrick, we certainly appreciate your participation in the network, and thank you so much for your support of MetaTreks.
If you'd like to follow Patrick Devlin, our new associate producer, his Twitter handle is just @MagicDrop5. It's spelled exactly like it sounds, MagicDrop5, MagicDrop5. And Mike, why don't you tell our listeners how they can become associate producers if they're interested in supporting what we're doing here on MetaTreks, and how they can help support the Trek.fm network?
Absolutely, Zachary. I actually got involved with Trek FM through the Patreon program. I became an associate producer of Warp 5, which I'm still an associate producer today. By going to patreon.com/trekfm, you can check out all of the different contribution levels. And at a level of $25 or more, you too can be an associate producer, and we'll give you a shout out right here on the podcast.
We should say that it costs an enormous amount of time and resources to keep Trek FM going and to keep content coming to you each and every day. So if you enjoy what we're doing here on MetaTreks, or if you're enjoying what we're doing on Trek.fm to keep Star Trek discussion alive and coming to you every day, please consider becoming a supporter of the network on Patreon. And that helps us out greatly and helps keep this the dream of Trek.fm alive.
Yeah, everything that's given, Zachary, helps. And there are multiple contribution levels. It could be as little as $5. It could be as much as 100 or more. And again, every bit helps. And there are definitely some great perks out there for listeners who want to contribute and support the network at any level.
So once again, welcome, Patrick, to the MetaTreks team. And thanks for supporting the Trek FM network. Well, everyone, thank you for listening to MetaTreks, a Star Trek philosophy podcast. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before.